The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. The last time I chatted with this man in podcast form, well, first, actually, I'll ask you, how long do you think it is? I'm joined by Dan Speck, one of the owners of Henry Appellum. I am here right now in their gorgeous winery and definitely one of the best places to visit because like they're open, I think, like almost every day of the week, even during the off season. And you can taste, you can try, you can buy, and it's just pretty as hell. But Dan, well, let's do this Price is Right style. Can you guess the month and the year, the last, when we did our first podcast together?
Guess. Okay. Yes. I'm going to go November 2018.
December 2018. Damn no good. Really? You were off by a month and you were under. So you win. You didn't go over the amount.
I'm not going to lie. I just go with my gut on these things and I almost always get it right when it comes to figuring out dates. If I used the front part of my brain, it never would.
Yeah.
But when I just kind of go with it, that's incredible. It was 2018.
It was December 2018.
No real clue.
By the way, do you do this? Now, this is off topic. Talking about wine. When I wake up in the middle of the night, I will guess what time it is, and then I will look at my clock, and I get it surprisingly close, and I get too much pride from that.
I totally do, and I can also wake up exactly when I'm supposed to, but I've got another bizarre superpower, like in the category of like useless things mm-hmm. I can do, because I often set the table for dinner at home,
yeah.
Always have, and when I reach into the box that has all the napkins, I always grab the right number without counting. I just sort of randomly stick my hand and pull them out, and
wow.
It's always got the right number.
That is a good superpower.
Yes.
I always know the music playing in the background faster than anyone else around me.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You just got to go with your gut.
Yeah. I don't think that's a superpower. If it is, I don't know who the villain is I'd be facing off against if that was my superpower.
I mean, I can also basically outdrink anyone I know, mm-hmm. except my brothers.
Yeah. Ooh, that'd be a good one. Rank the brothers about best to least alcohol tolerance.
Yeah. I mean, I've got age on my side. I'm the youngest.
Yeah. So where I wanted to start here was actually kind of do a catching up since we spoke 3.5 years ago about things that have happened in the wine industry. There was a lot of predictions you told me. This was a different time when we met up. But let's just start with this. COVID is, I don't want to say COVID is done because then someone will get angry and will point to numbers and why you need to wear masks. And then you get into a yelling match. And I don't want any part of that. But just COVID is basically over. I'm wondering just the impact that COVID had on Henry Appellum and the wine industry in general.
It was insane. As we all know, everyone has their own war stories coming out of that. The booze business in general, it rocketed depending how you were being, how you sold your products. So if you were in grocery, that helped because a lot of people just ran in, grabbed their favorites and ran out. It wasn't, you know, a lot of pantry loading going on that way.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, you know, drank their cellars dry too because they didn't want to go out and shop. So you had a bunch of things going on there. By and large, I think it was good for consumption on that level, but it's starting to come back down to earth. And you know, there's the dry January and all this kind of stuff, people trying to level set their lives again, I think. But mm-hmm. but it was yeah, I won't lie. I mean, I think everyone listening here, if you drank wine or whatever, you probably drank more of it, right?
Well, yeah, because you're stuck at home and wine is an event. So you're stuck at home not doing everything. You want to make Tuesday a little more special, even though every day started to kind of feel the same, and opening up a nicer bottle of wine. At the very least, you kind of felt like, okay, we're doing something. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's more wine consumption.
I think so. I mean, you know, we took the, you know, the muffler off basically and just said, what the hell, we're going to have good, make the best of this situation. You know?
Yeah.
I'm very close with my family, my brothers, of course, my kids, my wife, like we're a very tight family. They were both in high school at the time. And we just said, you know, like, what are we going to do here? We're going to cry in our soup, you know, like let's yeah. make the best of it. And we had singing, big parties, like we're singing their musical, we were drinking wine and cooking. And I became very close with my family, even closer through the pandemic, to be honest with you. It's again, trying to find the silver lining in it. I know a lot of people were really struggling and it was a tough time, but I think if you had good people around you, it made it a lot easier. And, you know, a little bit of wine didn't hurt.
Agreed on all of that. And we're both lucky that I was, it certainly didn't hurt any of my relationships, family, girlfriend, or anything during COVID. Did it help with the local scene? Was there spikes at all in that? Just because maybe people couldn't travel out of the country, so then maybe people did more wine touring in Niagara, Prince Edward County, Pelee Island. And so, was there any sort of spike in your sales because of COVID?
In two ways, yes. Excuse me. The first was our online sales prior to the pandemic were very, very modest. And then overnight it became a major channel for us. Major. Like it was, and by total happenstance, my brother Paul had been really leaning into trying to get that infrastructure in place. And probably by the fall, when we met, around the time we met in 2018, mm-hmm. Paul had been really, you know, doubling down on that. So we were actually ready for it when it happened, just dumb luck. And then the second thing was, it was interesting, the visitation to the wineries. We didn't know what that was going to look like. And if anybody was out, you know, it was strange, right? You had to sit outside, or you had to be all the distancing and all that, which was so bizarre. And yet people came, they were desperate for some sort of
contact,
yeah. To do something different. Right. And so, yeah, it was busy and our, you know, our costs were a bit lower, and that was a lifesaver. There's no question.
Mm-hmm. By the way, virtual wine events, man, those sucked.
I'm out.
Yeah. Oh, I hosted some for the National Club.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was happy to do it because it's a project, it's an assignment. At least you get to see people and try different wines. But man, it's like Zoom wine events suck.
It is not the vibe. And also with wine, like you're passing the glass around and there's the trading the bottles around. You just can't, I mean, you can open 6 or 8 bottles of wine. I mean, mm-hmm. it's crazy.
Yeah.
And then anything virtual is not the same.
It 100%. One of the other things that we talked about was one of my visits, not during the podcast. It's funny, the podcast was much more light. We're starting a lot more serious. We tried all your Bacco Noirs. That was a really fun one. And I think I was the first person to ever use a Das Boot analogy to describe your Bacco Noirs, which was incredibly impressive wines. But you talked about the war in Ukraine and how that was going to lead to costs going up. And we spoke once early. This was before everyone was talking more about supply chains and all that. That prediction of yours came true. The prices of wine.
100% it did. And you know, it's a surprising amount of glass travels around the world, by which I mean bottles. And so, and then all the craziness that happened with freight and such out there, depending on where you were, you know, sourcing things. We buy domestic glass as well. It's just a mixture. It's a global commodity at the end of the day. And it turns out that our European supplier, our main Italian supplier, as it happens, for bottles, is actually brokering the glass in from Ukraine. And so we didn't know that. No one really knew that. I think a lot of Europeans were quite surprised by that, to be honest with you, because I know people over there. And unfortunately, there was some destruction to one of the plants. Another one had to shut down in Ukraine. I mean, it's just the horror of that whole story over there. But yeah, glass supply got very crazy. And glass coming in from Turkey then, and it was like China. It was like, then the local supply, and then the color of the glass we could get was never consistent. It was real. My brother Matt, who runs the production side, I think aged about 10 years in that process in our winemaking team.
And then the other one, just inflation and the overall just the rise of all costs. Like I see it at the LCBO, like the wines that are normally, like the Gugel Cote de Rhone.
Great bottle.
For the longest time, I would use that for my great wine under $20. Now it would have to be my great wine that's under $25. It might not seem like a lot, but that wine went up from normally around 19 to now 25. That's a pretty big by percentage increase. And that's something we've seen. I think that's something that we've seen across the board.
100%. I mean, I was shocked when some of the value price brands in the liquor board in Ontario, and this would apply anywhere, all of a sudden overtook our sort of mid-price brands. And, you know, there's a lot of mythology about there that, you know, domestic wine is more expensive, or at least Ontario wine is expensive. If, you know, go into the general list of the LCBO and compare Ontario, for example, with VQA wines with, pick any country, I mean, Australia, California, they're very competitively priced. I mean, a lot of wines under $20, whereas the standard now in California is about $20 a bottle for, and you can get everything, by the way.
Yeah.
The big brands, the ones that actually do all the volume, they're all $20 bottles of wine. You can buy a $15 bottle of wine versus some of the big brands out of Australia where they shot up to like $17.95, $18.95. Some of those that were even the same, were line priced with Ontario before. So Ontario's a very good deal right now. I think people sometimes get thrown off a bit because when they go to the wineries, you're typically spending more at a winery.
Yeah.
But that's also because you're at the home and you're probably trying some like super exclusive reserve tier wine, which is not reflective of what's broadly available out there.
Well, yeah, because those wines are going to be, they're going to make, you know, the same thing here. There's going to be ones here that might find at the LCBO where it's making 500 cases. You know, if it's, you know, K-Luce or I'm just looking at the places around here or Batchelder or Westcott, you know, there's some of their wine, actually Westcott now, they're actually all over the place at the LCBO. But you're right. I think people do get sticker shock when they see $50. And their brain goes, 50? I would never, that's not something that usually computes for Canada. It's usually what you think of for an Amarone or a Napa Cab.
Yeah, for sure. And if you, Napa's a great example. I mean, if you go to a winery in Napa, the prices are...
The average is high. Well over 100 American.
Yeah, they're very high. And they're, are they expensive or are they just very premium wines? I'm going to err on the side of the latter and give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yep.
That's true when you visit wineries anywhere in the world, to be honest with you. But if you go, the wine that is sold, the other 95% of it, which is, you know, not sold at the wineries, most wineries will do most of their business at retail, and that's true the world over. There's a very high, large quantity of high quality, high value wines from Ontario, $15 bottles of wine, $17 bottles of wine that are amazing.
Like, for instance, the Family Tree line.
Well, I mean, you brought it up. Should I open it?
Yes. By the way, Dan's been very nice. We're going to try three different wines. The Family Tree, the Henry Pelham Family Estate Cab Merlot. And then the other one I'm interested in is, you guys have been doing some work with Bordeaux. Okay, by the way, now I got to stop. What people don't know is how professional Dan was there. He was pouring the wine. I was just talking to buy time. Dan put the mic so you could hear the pouring. That was awesome. When most winemakers leave the mic 3 feet from their mouth when they're talking, you, sir, are professional.
You know, I was actually getting a charcuterie board, and if you're starving, we got what's this thing called? It's called, Carnivore Club.
Mm-hmm.
You know Carnivore Club?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we've known these guys forever, so they send us one every month. If you're hungry, we'll get some and bring the box in and have it with the wine here.
This is the Family Tree Cab Merlot. I'm going to sniff and take a sip, but what's the percentage? What's the blend? What's the story behind this fella?
So Family Tree is a whole lineup of wines that my brothers and I created a number of years ago. And there's a lot of personality in these wines. First and foremost, this one's called the Padre, and it's in honor of our father. It's three grapes. We're three brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, and Merlot. And that'll be a theme in this tasting.
Yep.
And we call it the Padre, like I say, in honor of our father. But this is also, a lot of people wouldn't know this, but he had a career before all of this as a Catholic priest, which is a whole crazy story. So, you know, the unholy triumvirate of Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, and Merlot, our dad, the whole thing. It's an Niagara Peninsula expression. So we're sourcing from the whole region to get the kind of consistency. That's always been the modus operandi behind the Family Tree brand. When it started, it was all regional blends, no varietals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of morphed into something that's more varietally driven, but it's always about a regional expression.
Red fruit driven, not stocky. You know, sometimes my concerns are always, oh, okay, a sub $50 Ontario cab. I'm like, here comes the green bell pepper. None of that, no stockiness, lovely wine, smooth, very drinkable, red fruit driven Cabernet. Those are sort of those are the notes I get on this wine.
I totally agree. Yeah. And a nice smokiness to it. Maybe I drink this a lot at home. Actually, it's kind of my go-to, always open on the mm-hmm. counter somewhere, you know, and very, I think this whole family of wines, the Family Tree brand, is very, very friendly, very approachable.
And what's the price point for this?
$17.95.
That's fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's great. This is, as you're saying, like looking for sub $20, which I think is now that's the, if you can find a good wine for sub 20, you're laughing. And also what I find a lot is the more inexpensive California Cabernet dominant wines, lot of sugar, some chemical feel to it. Like it just, and then I'll go look sometimes at how many grams of sugar per liter. And I get scared off sometimes by say a $23 bottle of California Cabernet.
Yeah. I mean, look, we're, there's, like I said, tons of value for money in what's going on in Ontario and in the Bordeaux varietals too. I mean, this wine to be would be about half Merlot, half Cabernets, with the emphasis on Cab Franc, and you're picking that up in the bright red notes. But pour that against some $20 reds from other countries in the general list of the LCBO. I think you're going to be quite pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, because the most important thing for me is does it taste like the varietal? In the end, that's for me, that like people, because you know, you do the wine podcast and I spend money on wine because I don't have children. You know, it's the one thing I spend money on. And people are like, oh, you're a wine snob. Like, no. I'll drink plenty of stuff in the $20 range. All I ask for is not a high amount of sugar or chemicals. And does the wine taste like the grape? And that's all I ask for.
Yeah, for sure.
And actually, a shout out I should get. Actually, no, before that, I always like doing this. I always like doing sub-Appalachian talk. It's nerdy, but I think it's important to keep hammering it home so people start to understand different appellations, give different characteristics to the wines. You guys are Short Hills Bench. What should people know about wines and grapes sourced from this area?
So the Short Hills Bench is the easternmost bench appellation of the Niagara Escarpment Greater Appalachian. We have 90% of the south-facing slopes in Niagara in this one little area. So when we're planting our vineyards, we have these rolling hills, and we can play to the aspect of the hill to take advantage of more or less sunshine. Actually, you get comes with both sides, because you also have the cooler side of the hill, right? Mm-hmm. So you can, you know, we're growing Bordeaux varietals and Riesling in the same place, which is always that sort of interesting.
That is
debate, right?
Yeah.
And it's. On average, though, because of those slopes, it'd be one of the warmer regions it's the second warmest of the sub-Appalachians.
Well, it's funny, like what it works for. If it works for Bordeaux and Riesling, that means it has range.
Yes.
You know, because one usually think more cool climate and Bordeaux needs a little more sun.
Correct. Yeah. Well, that's when we've got the heat units. I mean, Niagara gets on average about 1400 growing degree days. It's a measurement of hours over 12 degrees Celsius in the growing season, GDD. Mm-hmm. Anyways, it's one measure. It's not the only measure, but it that puts it in the range, believe it or not, of Napa, except the difference is it's in a much more compressed time frame. So
right.
We're not Napa. We're completely different, but you do get pretty intense summers there. I think we're coming up on one this year. That's from what I'm reading.
Well, you never got a winter.
I know. Right now, was it 17 degrees? You were outside before. It was 14. Yeah. I mean, it's been beautiful today. And it's, what is it, March
4th.
4th.
Yeah. I went for a walk today, like up the hill to Rockway.
Yeah.
I was sweating.
Yeah.
When do you sweat on March 4th?
It's incredible.
Yeah.
I've had an amazing season.
Actually, okay. So to put in perspective, the 1400 hours, what would be other regions that it would be similar, like climatically? And I'm going to, hold on. Let's listen.
This wine is actually grown in the Short Hills Bench 100% that we're trying now, the second one.
That is the... Hold on, wait for it. What is it?
So this is the Henry of Pelham Cabernet Merlot, but it's from our estate range. We call this wine the Schoolhouse. It's from the Short Hills Bench, all of it. Mm-hmm. And it's... If you stand up there, can you see? Oh, I shouldn't even have to. You see that red schoolhouse back there?
Yes, I can.
So that's not what that is. That's
so okay.
The end of the vineyard. That's all Cab and Merlot around it.
Yep.
And my cousins and all that, they went to that school a million years ago. It's now somebody's home. And the foundations of the building are all that pink limestone that the old retail store of our property here, you've been there,
yep,
is built out of that same stone. So anyways, my parents were school teachers and they ran a high school in Toronto, and we kind of thought we'd try to connect all those ideas together.
That's so cool. Well, again, you were talking earlier about just how close you were with the family during COVID, and it's funny, like Henry Pelham feels like one of the quote-unquote larger wineries in the area. But yet it is like everything is so tied into family, like the names, the blends, the bottles, the labels. I mean, family is such a big part of what you do here.
It is. Yeah. You know, we grew up as kids planting these vineyards, working out here. Well, my parents ran their school in Toronto and we worked there as well. We had this large extended family that we started to get to know. But, you know, I've been lucky since I've worked with my brothers for over 40 years now. And that's been a really interesting process and an evolution of things. And then, you know, when I had my own kids, I've loved the experience of being a father, raising these guys, and learned so much about myself and my parents by having kids. It's probably the best thing that ever happened to me was to have a family and raise kids. Second best thing was to be a part of this winery. They're very, very lucky, and to be taken seriously. I mean, I think my brothers would probably say the same.
So the grapes sourced from back there. That's the yes. My sense of direction is horrible. Is that the northwest?
That's north, yeah,
yeah.
Okay. So yeah, northwest, exactly. Yeah. So this wine in the top left corner of the label will say estate, mm-hmm. and make sure I got that right. No, top right corner. Sorry, I just changed the label. So it says estate, and so what that means is that it's. From our 300-acre property, 250 acres of vines, and it's from so we have Cabernet, Franc, and Sauvignon of different and Merlot of different ages and on different sites. We bring the best of those together to make this wine, and then we have another level of this wine, which is a little higher, where it's a barrel selection and typically more single vineyardy, depending on the varietal that we're working with. So this is a Short Hills Bench expression of Cabernet. In Ontario.
And this is the 2020. It's funny. I was talking with this one winemaker and I was asking him, you know, his favorite, best vintages, worst vintages that he's worked. And he purposely left off 2020 because he was saying it's like, it's getting so much attention. I want to highlight. He talked about how much he loved 2019. He said 2021 was a piece of shit. I mean, made great wine, but still it was a wet year. So a very difficult year. But your thoughts on the 2000 and the 2020 vintage and what it meant for your reds?
Well, I'll say this. If depending where we go here, I've got a 2019 up there we can crack open because I always have lots of wine handy. So just mm-hmm. keep that in mind. But the 2020, it was a dream vintage. I mean, mm-hmm. it just everything behaved. You know, it rained when it was supposed to. It was sunny when it was supposed to be. Like, it was just, you know, you'd love those every year. And at the same time, it was definitely a Niagara vintage. Like, it's the wines have acidity, they have structure. They're going to be very long lived. I had a chance to try some of these wines going back to 1998. In fact, some of your colleagues came
from. Oh, we're getting there. I'm going to talk about this story that I've emailed you about. Okay. I've done on Instagram. I haven't talked about it on the pod. So hold it, because I'm going to get to that in a moment.
This is one of the great years. It'll age forever, and it's mm-hmm. super delicious, I think. And you know, it's young right now, but I'm enjoying mm-hmm. it. In fact, I think the 19 of this wine just hit the shelves in vintages by total coincidence, like a couple of days ago, or maybe it's next week. So
the great thing is you can tell the difference. We'll find out the price of this one in a moment. There's dark fruit as well. It's not just red fruit. This is red and then dark fruit. There's more spice. There's definitely like a more body in the mid palate. It lasts a lot longer. Like this, it's the great thing is it is okay. So now the other one, the family tree is 2022. So your entry level wine. And as I always say, you can always judge a good winery. How good is their entry-level wine? How much time and attention and care do they put into that where it's not an afterthought? But you can definitely feel the jump on the palate and on the nose of the 2020 Cab Merlot. And this is a great wine. And how did I do with me just talking straight for the last 35 seconds as you went and grabbed a different bottle?
Well, yeah, I had the night. I mean, I'm trying to keep my shelves full in my office because you never know when you need a good bottle of wine. So this is the 19, which we can try as a comparative, because you know 19 as a vintage got quite a bit overlooked by the 2020s. When you have these like blockbuster years, they take all the attention. Yeah, your wine writer for our winemaker
Rick Van. Oh yeah,
oh, Rick, or is it Rick?
That's no, it wasn't Rick. Yeah. Rick loved 2020. It was a different winemaker.
Sure,
I'm not going to mention because you know he told me off. He's like, I'm not going to mention 2020 because he's you know you don't want to get other vintages overshadowed.
Well, yeah, it's I mean it's like catch 22. I mean we make our lives really difficult in the wine world because we every year we're reselling it because we're telling the vintage story, mm-hmm. which you know would be a lot easier to not have to deal with that. On the other hand, that's kind of what makes wine cool, or at least at the higher end.
Yeah,
and I love it. And if you can make a decent wine every year with what you're growing, or if you're not bold enough to declassify it and skip a vintage, then you shouldn't be focusing on it and growing it. And that's so we'll blend down as needed or skip vintages if you know maybe we're happy enough with it, but we don't need to because we have some left over from the previous year that we're still selling because it was such a good year we scaled up. There's those decisions that go into winemaking. 2019 was an interesting year. The acidity is totally different structure. Like they're more zippy, but I think they're aging out beautifully. I mean, I love these 19s, but they just took a little longer to express mm-hmm. right there, or they had to get out of their awkward stage. Took a little longer to get to where they want to be. So check them out. Like I wouldn't dismiss them at all.
Well, any good winemaker is always going to make good wine. It's the same thing, you know, in Bordeaux. You're going to spend more money for 10, for 15, for it seems every 5 years. I always go and grab the quote-unquote bad vintages because you can get that same bottle for like 40, 50 bucks less, and it can be, you know, it can be fantastic. The one we're drinking now, the 20 Cab Merlot, what's the price point for this?
Yeah, $27.95.
Again, that's great. Like that's you're under 30 Bordeaux blend wine. That wine's great. Like this is a really good expression. What I wanted to ask you about is, would you say that the family tree is going to be more? There's going to be less vintage variation. It's going to be you're going to know what you're going to get, which is fantastic for weekday wine. And then from your family staying up, every year is going to be more expressing what that year was.
Absolutely. Like so, the idea with a wine like Family Tree is that we're declassifying down into it. So it might have wines that are 25, 30, even higher of some portion of those blended down into it to support the wine so you get much more consistency. Like it's not about celebrating the vintage in a wine like that. You're really about, it's just old reliable. You want it to be, you got to know what you're getting every time.
Yeah.
When you get into the more interesting sort of upper tier wines, you still have to have dependency. You got to be able to go say, yes, it has to be dependable. It has to be something that you know is going to be good. It's important to us that if you pull a bottle of our wine off the shelf, a reserve level, you know, a state level Henry of Pelham, that the wine is going to deliver. But this is how it is with higher end wine, especially from Northern European climates, which is effectively what we are. We are not a New World climate here,
yeah,
like a Mediterranean climate at least. We are producing wines that have vintage expression. And that's like a good thing because we focus on the best part of that. We declassify the less exciting parts of it as well and keep the quality very high at all levels. So it's a whole strategy of producing the best wine in every vintage at every price point and not having wild fluctuation in your pricing.
I think people that listen on a regular basis are like, okay, Cos, you are biased when it comes to Niagara. And on some level I am because I've tried all this really good stuff. I get to meet all these fascinating people. Oh, wait, hold on. There we are.
I'm intrigued to try these next to each other. I haven't done that in a little while.
Yeah, trying the 20, then we'll try the 19. Then it's like, okay, what's the examples? Don't just say you love these wines. Give the examples. And this happened to me about a year ago. I was at the National Club. Friend Jeffrey Johnson.
The great
Jeffrey Johnson, who has a giant cellar. He is, you know, an older British man, and he is the stereotype.
Wild man.
Oh, God, yeah. But because he's British, he loves claret. Yeah. And he's got tons of old Bordeaux. And we had a dinner one night, and to enjoy his 2002 Latour, I had to try. There was brains, testicle, chicken feet, worm, salt. So salt made from worms.
Jesus.
Yes.
I had with Jeffrey, by the way, he's an amazing caterer and has one of the most important catering companies. I'm always afraid to say that after all the things you just described.
Yeah.
He not only has he made tripe delicious, because I hate tripe.
Wow, he made tripe delicious.
He made tripe delicious. I had the weirdest spirit I've ever had. And I don't know if I'm going to freak people out when I say this. It was described to me. It was basically like a soju, which is kind of like a vodka, in an unlabeled bottle with, this is how it was described, aborted rat fetuses floating in it. It was just like, what in the hell is this?
Holy shit. What the fuck? Okay, you know
I'm
what?
Like, well, I'm in. Let's do it. I took a shot of that.
Oh,
like,
my God. By the way, Dan, you win. I was going to mention
that's Jeffrey
dried grasshoppers from his garden with 100-year-old sherry. I've tried maggots with Margot. Your one there, it wins.
Well, he's the guy who's a big believer in the cordyceps, right? You know, mm-hmm. Cordyceps is those fungi, those mushrooms that take over the ants and control their brains. It's like that TV show. What's the thing? The End of Us, Last of Us.
Yeah, Last of Us.
So
yeah.
That's based on the concept of the cordyceps. Jeffrey, these things actually exist. Jeffrey is like a fiend for eating those, apparently. He's a great guy. We should get together and do something there.
He's been on the pod ages ago. By the way, check out On Veal Catering. There's lots of what we just said for last night.
No, that's serious food. Oh, yeah. That's a great catering company.
But
On Veal.
Circling back. Here's one of the things about the quality of not only what Henry of Pelham does, but also for people out there that don't think you can make great age-worthy Bordeaux blend wines. We paired an 02 Latour with one of your 02 Cab Merlots.
Oh, no way.
It was a fantastic dinner. Okay, the Latour was quote unquote the better wine.
Well, it
was
$1,000 a bottle or something.
It was about $1,000 more expensive, but the O2 Camarlot was right there with it. It belonged. It fit in. You didn't drink one and then drink the other, and you could. There wasn't like some giant quality gap. It's just two wines that were both excellent. And it was, you know, I had it probably about 2 years ago. So it was like 20, 21-year-old, one of your Bordeaux blends. And it matched up and it belonged on the table with the Latour. And I say this story because I always like to give specific examples. Mm. So for people who wonder about the quality of what we do here, well, there was a wine you made over two decades ago going up against one of the iconic Bordeaux blends.
That's, well, thank you. That's a great story. I remember... when our Jancis Robinson, she was doing her guide to North American wines, and I want to say it was Tony Aspler, went over to see her. I hope it was Tony. I'm not telling this the wrong way. But he poured for her our 98 Cab Merlot at the time. And it was such a great response that she included it as a full page shot and a whole story around that wine. And it just, you know, it just goes to show you, I mean, this we're, you know, Canadians are so modest. We don't always, you know, sing our own praises, but yeah, the wines like that do exist here, and we're not the only one. There's lots mm-hmm. of them. I can think of to give you 10 examples of wines like that being produced here.
Yeah,
with history though, not just like a one-off. You know, it's fine to do it once, but can you do it with consistency?
Yeah, you can tell the difference on the 20 versus the 19.
Yeah, the acid structure is different. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's still density, I think, of flavor and richness in the 19. It's got a little more zippy in its acidity, but it's got those evolved notes to it, sort of the meatiness that comes with a little bit of age. You know, it's 2019, so it's 5 years. It's not like a million years old, but it'll continue to age and express.
Yeah, you're starting to get a little bit of that earthy. Mm-hmm. It's coming there. A little bit of that mushroom is coming through with that wine. Yeah, so again, fantastic. Like, you know, close to around the $30 range.
$27.95. These are the same price. I mean, that's the other thing, you know, that often gets overlooked, I think, because why would people know this? But you'll see really broadly appellated wines, you know, that are $25, $30, not very specific. Some of the most, a lot of the $30 wines you see, you know, in the Essentials and Vintages and such, which is great. These are massive, massive brands. Doesn't mean they're not good at all. Mm-hmm. But here, you know, from Ontario, because we're a small wine region full of small wineries, even our biggest wineries are not that big, mm-hmm. you know, are selling small production, like you said, 500, 600 case brands. Those are actually, that's like these wines. These are like, you know, 500 to 1,000 cases in a good year. You know, they're very small production wines. But that's true of all of our wines. Even the wines in the general list are not giant SKUs by yeah. you know, global terms, you know.
I focus more on your Rieslings and your Pinots. Mm. I love those ones. I think I might, you know, just turn a little bit over more to the Bordeaux blends. Because, yeah, it's been a while, especially the family tree. I'm always looking. And it's funny, my girlfriend as well, she'll get intimidated still, even though I try my best to help her out, about like, where are the $20 and under wines?
So those wines, the family tree wines, are how we celebrate our shady roots. Mm-hmm. And if you dig into them, there's some great wines. The Goat Lady Chardonnay.
Yep, had it many times.
You've had that. That's that barn over there, right?
Yep.
Just across the road, that was the Goat Lady's farm. She's a real lady who kidnapped our dog and fed him goat roasts and washed his eyes out with goat's milk. It's very witchy, but he loved it. He left us. He abandoned us, really. But, you know, very friendly, easy drinking Chardonnay. There's a Sauvignon Blanc in there and a Pinot that's about to come out called the Boxer's Ghost. That wine's a delicious bottle of wine.
Totally off topic. Is there a varietal that your wife doesn't like?
Oh, my wife? Yeah, that's easy. Like almost everything. She basically drinks Chardonnay.
Okay. Well, first off, if you have to pick one, great.
And Chardonnay's Albarino, perfect. Interestingly, because they're totally opposite. But
see, I bring it up because my girl hates Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah, my wife, she'll never touch it. She hates it.
And not just Marlborough. And by the way, I feel bad for Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc. There is good Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc. Sure. We shit on it all the time. But Loire, no. Bordeaux, no.
I can get Louise to crank a Sancerre once in a while.
Oh, no.
But that's a stretch.
Total no. So Amy was away. So that's when I opened up some old dry Sauternes that I had. It's like some great, you know, Bordeaux whites.
I love Bordeaux white. That is a total unsung hero. Even just like basic Entre de Mer.
Yep.
Why not? Like with some Semillon or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, great wines.
It really is. It's, if I look at, to me, the two underrated white wine regions, but it's because it's dominated by reds, is Southern Rhone, maybe Northern Rhone and Bordeaux. Great, great white wines that got overshadowed by the reds.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, it's such a crazy thing with Bordeaux, talking about Bordeaux for a second, even about the reds. I was at Wine Paris Vin Expo. They put the two things together now a couple of weeks ago in Paris. I was talking to a couple of Bordeaux producers. It's crazy over there. Like they are ripping vineyard out. They're way oversupplied. And I had a wine from somebody. Now I'm doing here I am selling Bordeaux, but I was talking to, I had a wine from a producer who makes a very well-known brand here. I'll drag him through it, but you know, very premium, very well-selling, excellent bottle of wine in the sort of 40 range, maybe even 50. He had a wine that I, like a second label, and I had a sip. I'm like, God damn, this is delicious. I mean, what is that, $25-$30? How much do you think it was?
I mean, if it's delicious Bordeaux,
yeah,
and you're liking it at that, $38.95.
Yeah, it's $13.1395. I was just, I could not believe it.
And where is it from? You don't have to give the title of the name, but what part of the world?
I think it was Bordeaux.
Okay.
I don't know the economics of that because it's a developed, I mean, it's, yeah. I know what the economics are. It's brutal. And so,
but a $14 Bordeaux wine, and that's
a serious bottle of wine.
And that's not 14 that you buy in the grocery store in Paris. It's a 14.
Right.
It's $14 that has traveled across the Atlantic.
Yeah, like it would be probably cheaper at home, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, now that's tough. There's a bunch of wine regions. Well, a lot of wine regions of the world that are really struggling right now, and it's a younger generation that has. It spends more on like a seltzer, mm-hmm, per beverage, per drink,
yeah,
than they are on wine. There's a communication issue that's missing in wine. You know, if you want like a plant-based, natural product, the most natural,
locally
all
sourced
beverage, locally sourced beverage, like it's hands down, it's wine. Even the most concocted wines are still that, more than those seltzers and 10 other things out there that you could be drinking. It's crazy. There's a messaging gap that we're not winning in the wine industry. But, you know, look, if you're a millennial and you haven't ever had wine that isn't sort of what they're pushing in restaurants, I'm going to take a swipe at natural wine here a little bit, because I think it's probably turned a lot of people off wine.
Yeah.
That is a very small subset of what wine is. A lot of people love it and I celebrate it. That's wonderful. That is not what most wine is. I fear that it might be actually turning people off of wine, and because they don't know. They're one sampling opportunities in a restaurant, and they try something that is very atypical of what 99.9% of wine is, and they probably would like that other 99.9% because they certainly love consistent fruit forward seltzers, like beers that are clean and easy to approach. They love cocktails that celebrate fruit and freshness.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, that's wine, but it's the most natural product on earth.
First off,
it takes some hate on that one. But
more now, most natural wine is horse shit, and it smells like horse and it tastes like horse. The problem I always have with natural wine is not the idea behind wanting it unfiltered and all these things and trying to make it represent the terroir. The problem is when people go over the top, and it's almost less about creating wine and more about marketing. It's more about like, look what we do. It's more, look how wonderful we are. And it's at the sacrifice of quality. That's my problem, is that when natural wine is more of a marketing than it is actually good quality wine. So that's always my issue with it. I don't like most natural wine. I don't like most orange wine. Southbrook, you do a good one. You do a good one, Southbrook.
I think orange has a greater opportunity for quality than the natural, yeah, wines in general, because and there's lots of debate within that and range within that, but I think there you're still going after something more like clean winemaking. And you know, the distinction being that, you know, a wine fault is something you're trying to drive out of wine. I mean, I'll tell you, if this notion of like faulty wines becomes really commercially viable, the biggest wine companies in the world can scale that up in a second and drop the price, and you'll have the biggest brands will be that. They'll be the Coca-Colas of
yeah,
orange wine. It's not like it's, or not orange wine, but a natural wine. It's just not like it's, it's hard to make oxidized wine or Brettanomyces and wine. It's hard to not get those things. That's the irony of it.
And any good winery, even if they're not bio, they're not certified. Trust me, any good winery, they're organic. They are treating the field so well because it only hurts them not to. You know. By the way, DRC. You know, Aubert de Vallon, he uses sulfur. Okay, so everyone relax on that.
Yeah, and it's one of the greatest wines.
Yeah, that none of us were history. We'll never get to try.
Oh yeah, maybe it isn't. Who knows? I'm sure it is.
This is way off topic. I have so many other actually questions I wrote down. Again, this 19's drinking just beautifully.
Yeah, it's fresh. Eh?
My other theory is the seltzer love that it has like no sugar. So part of it is, I'm not saying about vanity, but about wanting to consume less sugar. I want to get drunk or altered or just buzzed. I want that feeling of buzzed, but I don't want any sugar. And so I'll drink something that tastes like when it was 1983 and it hit midnight on your TV and it was the fuzz. Because that's what White Claw tastes like. That's what White Claw tastes like. But at least you go, well, I might not be enjoying this, but at least I'm getting buzzed and there's no sugar.
I think people are like, you know, calorie obsessed. So there's an element of that going on right now. I think that the one mistake we make is when we talk about grams of sugar per liter is extremely misleading. Hmm. And I'll tell you why.
Yeah, explain.
So what is the standard unit that you buy a bottle of wine in?
750.
That is not a liter, right?
Yeah.
So when you talk grams per liter, you're already talking about something that is not the standard unit. Now, when I eat a bag of chips, you know, when my kids come home with the Halloween candy and I steal all their like little Frito-Lays bag and I pick that up and I go look at the calorie on the back, which like I never do, but if I did, when I look at that, does it give me the carbohydrates per kilo?
Mm-hmm. No.
No, it gives me per serving size.
Right.
Like everything. So we should be talking grams of sugar per serving size. And the thing is that we have national standards. In fact, there's even international standards, but there's national standards within Canada for what is the grams per liter of alcohol, for sugar, for all these things. And when you start digging into it, wine is not that bad. And, you know, you buy some of these coolers, you know, they're not all zero sugar. Yeah. Some of the, you know, I won't name them out, but the tomato-based ones that use clams in them and stuff have, you know, double-digit grams per liter in a single serving, which would be like a liter of wine. And all of it is meaningless because you're not comparing apples to apples. I'd also say that it's not consistent in how it's labeled on the shelves. So we only talk about residual sugar in wine, but you know, what's the residual sugar in amaretto? Mm-hmm. What's the residual? Well, it's not on the bin tag.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, and then are you mixing that Jack or the whiskey you're going to have with a Coca-Cola? Well, what's the grams per liters of a Coca-Cola?
Pretty high.
Right? So again, it's not to take a hit at any of these things. It's just if you're trying to inform the consumer, you have to speak apples to apples and be transparent. I don't think there's a desire to not be transparent. I just think there's like a huge opportunity to clarify the message.
Yeah, I think that is important, especially to get people that are under 30. Hey, under 30-year-olds, try the family tree. You know, especially if you're just starting out and rent is crazy expensive, try the family tree. So
plant-based.
Yes.
Local.
There you go. One question I wanted to ask you about, I was talking with this one guy in the industry the other day, and he said this would be an interesting issue, is succession plans.
Yeah.
Now, for you guys, it's not imminent because you and your brothers, you're still young. You know, it's not like, that. What's that?
Thanks for saying that.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
turned 50 this year. I'm the youngest, but yes.
Oh, mazel tov. All right. I'm 48, so I'm the youngster. So that makes me feel good. But, you know, there's a lot of wineries here that are owned by people in their 70s where maybe they don't have kids that don't want to get into the industry. I'm just wondering, maybe it hasn't been brought up, but
it has.
Okay, so yeah, I'm just wondering, what is the conversation around the idea of succession plans when it comes to a lot of the wineries in Niagara or in Ontario in general?
Family businesses are inherently the worst kinds of businesses. And yet, something like half of the Fortune 500 companies are family businesses. Mm-hmm. It's this crazy thing. It's that Built to Last book is a great, great book if you haven't read it. And it talks all about this. And one of the things it talks about. And so, you know, great companies have other dynamics working for them. Culture matters. They professionalize themselves. They're sophisticated. And, you know, these are all the things that, you know, no one likes to think about with wineries. But we're just small businesses in our case. Like, we're trying to, you know, figure out how to get a great bottle of wine onto the shelf and tell our story. And it's an expression of us. But our kids are young enough that we don't have to worry about it just yet, but they're old enough that they're a threat. So they're all in school. A couple of them have graduated. My oldest brother's kids have graduated. They're figuring out their own thing. And we think a lot about it. Yeah, I think this is the next decade for us is what happens. And you know, I'm optimistic that there's some really talented people in our family that if they express the interest, could get into it. But, you know, I'd say two things. One is that you really have to want to do this. I don't want anyone who's trying to carry on a legacy or something, because that's a recipe for disaster. You know, it's like you break it, you bought it. Well, if you take it on, it's yours to break.
Yeah.
And you can't keep it run it a certain way just because dad or the uncles would do it. So that's going to be a hard needle to thread, but we'll see.
Yeah, because, I mean, in Europe, you know, everywhere you go, it's like, oh yeah, I took over for my father in 2011. Or there's like everywhere I've traveled in France, in Germany, it's always very much just passed along from one family to the other. And yeah, I do wonder what it's going to be here in Ontario.
Well, I got a little beer coaster on my desk here from an amazing smoked beer, Rausch beer. Right? Mm-hmm. It's one of the only true ones in the world. It's a smoked beer from Brauerei Heller in Bamberg. The beer is called Echt Schlenkerla Rauschbier.
By the way, Germany, could you come up with one syllable?
And that's written in Gothic, so I'm like working.
Good for you.
These guys are like, Matthias is like the nicest guy on the planet. And it's a little brewery. They've been making this beer. I think he's the eighth generation consecutively making this beer, and it is a really beautiful handmade product. You can find it in the LCBO. It's amazing. Echt, Aecht, Schlenkerla, Schlenkerla. I'll leave it at that. It's whatever. Anyways, the point of it is that there's some sort of like, and I think you'd appreciate this if I said it, this nerdy passion that seems to carry on in that family, and they've found a way to make this work. And it's wonderful. It's a really cool thing. But not every company is going to be that. Not every family is that family. And the Europeans also trim the tree. They don't. It's not always everybody's involved. Like, some people graduate into other things, and they, you know. So it's a tricky business.
What's the last wine? And it's something that we talked about one of my last times I visited you. That here we go. Yes, I was going to comment on that. Wow, this is
So the story here. In fact, if you think back on it, let me get this right. Was it 2018 or was it 2019? It was 2018. I was here. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the wine here is a Bordeaux. Mm-hmm. I was there the fall of 2018.
Yep.
Yes, because you wouldn't have had it because I'd just been there putting the blend together. So
one of my last times just visiting you just for a drink, not for podcast. Yeah, and you were telling me that you were getting involved in Bordeaux.
I've been looking at Bordeaux for a number of years. I kind of learned about wine through inexpensive Portuguese wine. The great Bordeaux's, because I was lucky enough to have some access to those. Of course, the wines we grow here in Ontario and maybe some Spanish wines. And port. I drank a lot of port. Mm-hmm. Good port. And I've always looked at Bordeaux. I've always loved Bordeaux. And you know, I was talking earlier about how there's this challenge to this industry. And I thought to myself, you know, maybe we should, you know, work with someone over there. I have a friend over there. Damien Chambard, who's been, you know, just trying to find new ways to the market. And we thought this would be cool. He's in a region called Cadillac, which is called Cadillac.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And initially we started up like, wouldn't it be cool to have a wine that had Cadillac on the label? Over there, they kind of shit on it. They're like, Cadillac. Oh, you're from Cadillac. Yeah.
Can't do that.
I'm like, Cadillac? We think of the Cadillac as, you know, the Cadillac.
Yeah.
So Damien and I were talking it out, trying to figure it out. Turns out we couldn't use that term on the label unless it was a white wine or a sweet wine or something, just totally ludicrous.
What?
One of these rules they have.
God, like labeling laws.
Constantly just shooting themselves in the feet. And so no end of frustration for Damien. I was like, well, let's put this thing together. Let's make we made a Merlot, a Cab, and a white, a Semillon Sauvignon Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
And let's try and make a wine that's a little more appealing to the North American palate of, you know, because I've been drinking a little bit of Grave and Haute Grave recently, and I can see why people don't necessarily gravitate to those wines if you're new to wine. They're pretty extracted and beast-like, you know?
Yep.
I was like, well, maybe there's a way to find something a little more accessible for a North American palate, a younger palate. We called the wine Mysterious Cave. And the reason why is that underneath his vineyard, there's literally like 100 kilometers of caves that were carved out like centuries, in some cases even millennia ago. But the centuries ago, they pulled these giant bricks out and built the city of Bordeaux out of them.
Huh.
And I say brick, I mean, they're like the size of like a small car. Like, they're huge, these things. And it's freezing in there. And he ages his barrels in there. I thought, this is so cool. He's like, really? I'm like, are you kidding?
That's
like amazing.
Yeah. You know?
So this is Cab Mystère. It's been coming out in vintages last number of years. They've been very supportive. It's a Merlot and there's a Cab Sauvignon, which I don't actually have one here. I think I have one at home. I should have brought it in. I forgot this morning. The Merlot has been out a few times. The Cab Sauv is coming out and it's getting a following.
All right. So it's
a long story.
Your connection with Bordeaux and Cadillac, for people who don't know, and I'm trying to remember.
It's Entre-deux-Mer.
Entre-deux-Mer. Okay. Yeah. So it's south of Bordeaux.
South end. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. South end of Bordeaux would be considered, I guess, left bank, but no, I mean, no, it's not left bank, right bank, it doesn't matter.
You know what I love about it is that it's not fancy. And I don't mean that the wines aren't elegant. What I mean is, you know, no chauvinism here. My favorite French word, chauvinism. There's no chauvinism. It's about, like, let the wine speak. Let the winemaker just do his thing. We're not celebrating appellation other than just Bordeaux. We're putting the varietal on the label.
Yep.
But it's elegant, premium. Nice presentation, the cool red label that I think is kind of funky and tells the story a bit.
This wine's velvet.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
This is this is more of a new world palette because it is a little bigger. There's more fruit and it's just, now this is like when George Costanza wanted to wear all, was it all velvet or all cashmere? No, not cashmere.
Yeah, yes.
It was like all, like it just wanted this velvet tracksuit. Like, honestly, that was one of the first thoughts that went through my head was George Costanza.
So, this is what I found so funny talking to Damien. I'm like, so Damien, you know, this wine's got to be, you know, it's got to have color. It's got to be, you know, luscious. It's got to be Bordeaux. It has to have acidity. It has to have a little bit of structure. It has to be Bordeaux. I don't want to make something that's not Bordeaux, but it's got to have a bit of horsepower to it. And he goes, yeah, I don't know. I mean, people around here hate that sort of wine and they keep telling, you know, we're not supposed to make that, basically. I'm like, what?
No, like chocolate notes and stuff. That's great.
I think it's a really nice wine, and that's like $19.
Yeah, this
it fits between Family Tree.
Yep,
and the Henry Pelham Cab Merlot. It's like sort of, well, I don't know. I think they're a bit of a kind. I mean, like we like literally had the wines going back and forth for a few months there between Damien and his team there. It's a very small winery, very modest setup to our winemakers, and debating it a bit. It was fun.
Here's the funny thing: your biggest wine is your Bordeaux.
Mm.
Now, usually you would think, oh, okay, well, the biggest wine will be the New World wine. No. You're like, the biggest wine for me has been the Mystery Cave. It's funny, if you poured that in your 2019 Cab Merlot and said, guess which one is from France? I would guess your
Cab Merlot.
I would guess your Henry Pelham Cab Merlot.
Well, yeah, and you know why? Because Henry, the Bordeaux reds that we make in Ontario, in Niagara right now, and always really, are more like classic Bordeaux than Bordeaux even today. They've kind of gone down a path, despite everything I just said, they've gone down a path of sort of a slightly larger style of wine.
Yeah.
And having said that, though, with Cave Mystère, we're trying to push that as far as we can. And this is also Merlot, keep in mind, not Cab Merlot. So.
You know, the worst part is we're almost done. We're like close to an hour. I was going to ask you about Doug Ford. I was going to ask you about the VQA to make a national standard, and Don Zeraldo was speaking about that. But I don't have time for that. I only have time for one more question.
All right, lay it on me.
Main thing you and your brothers will bicker about when it comes to all things wine would be what?
Man, that's a really interesting question for me.
All this talk of family and how, but is there something you guys bicker about when you're going to pick the grapes, blending, labels? Is there something that, and maybe there isn't. And if there isn't, that's fine. Wonderful as well.
No, I'm not trying to avoid your question because I'm happy to talk about anything and say, but we don't. There's not a lot of light between us when it comes to this. What's really important for us, obviously we want to make a wine that is distinctive and reflects the place and reflects our house style, our family style. And that's something that we're always talking about. We drink together, we eat together, we socialize together, we're in the lab tasting, samples of stuff. But we really are unified on one thing, which is that as much as this is about us making some kind of statement, and we do want to make a statement with our wines, we want each of those wines to make the right statement to the right customer. And I think it's important to think about who's drinking these wines. And too often in wine, that isn't the case. And that's also one of the things that can hurt wine. Like, who is this wine being made for? Not just, this is letting the land speak. I mean, yes, of course we're doing that. But are we making the right wine for the right person? Letting that land speak to the right person. I think that's a backwards way of thinking in wine, and yet I think it's the right way to think. And I think that's one of the things that differentiates us.
This has been great, Dan. It's been 3.5 years. I mean, I've seen you a bunch of times, but sure. First time doing the pod in 3.5 years. Where do people go? Websites, promote again. And for myself, I'm going to start getting a little bit more of your Bordeaux blends, but where do people go to get your stuff?
So henryofpelham.com. You can find our wines there. You can also go to specbros.ca. Think about that one. See, so Spec Brothers is a family of wines, interesting sort of experimental projects and stuff that's very cool. It's a real fine family tree. But, you'll find our wines across Canada. Go to the LCBO. Go to Harvest in Nova Scotia, great group of liquor stores out there. Quebec, the SAQ. I mean, just pick your province. You'll find us in about 20 countries now.
Cool.
Yeah. Air Canada.
Oh, that's awesome.
And on Arienta. Nice. Not Arienta, sorry. Aer Lingus and so on. So,
Dan, this has been great. Thanks for doing it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, iTunes, Apple, Spotify, wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.